Let me ask you something before we start. When you pull the dipstick out of the tank on your next pre-flight, what number are you actually looking for? Not the number that gets you to the airport. The number that gets you to the airport and then keeps going. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern here on Radio Hangar. Today we're going to talk about one of the shortest regulations in the whole book, and one of the ones that quietly shows up in accident report after accident report. Fuel. Specifically, Federal Aviation Regulation 9151-51, the VFR fuel requirement. It's a rule you can read in about 15 seconds. It's a rule you can misunderstand for an entire flying career. And I'll be honest with you, this is one I wish someone had really sat me down and explained when I was a student, instead of just pointing at the page and moving on. So let's walk through this together. Before we dig in, a quick shout out to our friends at AviationSoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the journey. Got your first solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot, instrument, commercial, they've got you covered. It's a great way to mark the milestones that matter. The ones you worked hard for, AviationSoul.com. All right, let's get into the rule itself. 9151 is titled Fuel Requirements for Flight in VFR Conditions. VFR being visual flight rules, the way most of us fly most of the time. And here's what it actually says in plain language. You may not begin a flight under visual flight rules unless, considering wind and forecast weather conditions, you have enough fuel to fly to your first point of intended landing, and then, assuming normal cruising speed, to fly after that for at least 30 minutes during the day or at least 45 minutes at night. That's it. That's the whole thing. Fly to where you're going. Then have 30 more minutes in the tank in the daytime, 45 more minutes at night. Now here's the part I really want you to hear today, because it's the part that gets people hurt. That 30 minutes is a legal minimum. It is not a plan. It is not a target. It is the absolute floor below which you have broken a federal regulation. And I promise you, the pilots who ran their tanks dry were, almost every single one of them, planning to land with more than 30 minutes. They just didn't get it. Let me say that a different way. Nobody takes off intending to run out of gas. Fuel exhaustion is not a decision. It's the result of 100 small things going a little worse than you expected, all stacking up until the number you planned on and the number in the tank quietly drift apart. So let's talk about how that drift happens, because if you understand the drift, you can defend against it. The first place it happens is the flight plan itself. You sit down, you figure your ground speed, you figure your burn, and you come up with a beautiful number, an hour and 40 minutes to your destination. The airplane holds 5 hours of fuel. Plenty, right? Here's the problem. Every number in that calculation was a forecast. The winds aloft were a forecast. Your cruise fuel burn came out of a book that describes a brand new airplane, leaned perfectly, flown by a test pilot, on a standard day. Your airplane is not new, you're probably not leaning it perfectly, especially early on, and that's okay. That's normal. But it means the book number and the real number are not the same number. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. The fuel burn in the pilot's operating handbook is the best case. It is the number under ideal conditions. Real flying lives above that number, not below it. So if the book says 9 gallons an hour, you flight plan on 10, maybe 11, you give yourself the pessimistic number, and you let the airplane pleasantly surprise you. The second place the drift happens is the climb. That first 1,000 feet, that first few 1,000 feet, the engine is at high power, the mixture is rich, and you are burning fuel far faster than your cruise number. If you flight plan the whole trip at cruise burn, you already told yourself a small lie right off the runway. A short hop where half the flight is climb can burn shockingly more than the cruise math suggests. Third place, the wind didn't read the forecast. You planned on a 15-knot tailwind and you got a 5-knot headwind instead. That's a 20-knot swing. On a long leg, that 20 knots doesn't just cost you a few minutes, it eats into your reserve directly, because you're spending more time in the air to cover the same ground, and time in the air is fuel out of the tank. And the fourth place, the one that gets everybody eventually. The plan changed. The airport you were headed to went below minimums, or there was traffic, or you got vectored the long way around, or you decided to divert, or you flew one more lap in the pattern because that last landing was ugly and you wanted a good one. Every one of those is fuel you didn't budget. Every one of those is real. Now stack those up. A little more burn than the book. A rich climb you didn't count. A headwind instead of a tailwind. A diversion at the end. Individually, none of them is a crisis. Together, they are exactly how a 5-hour tank and a 2-hour flight turn into an engine going quiet over terrain you didn't choose. So how do we fly this like professionals, even if we're brand new? Let's walk through it. First, plan your reserve as a real leg, not as leftovers. Don't plan the trip and then check whether 30 minutes happens to be left over at the end. Instead, decide up front what you land with. A lot of instructors, myself included, teach a 1-hour reserve for cross-country flying day or night, full stop. Not 30 minutes, not 45, 1 hour in the tanks on the ground at your destination.
Why an hour? When the reg only asks for 30 minutes in the day, because that extra buffer is what absorbs the drift. That's the headwind you didn't expect, and the diversion you didn't plan, and the pattern you flew twice. The regulation protects you from the last 30 minutes. Your personal reserve protects you from everything that tried to eat those 30 minutes before you got there. Second, know your airplane's real burn and know it in gallons per hour that you have actually seen with your own eyes. Not the brochure, not what the guy at the flight school told you, fill it up, fly it, fill it up again, do the arithmetic. Your airplane will tell you the truth if you ask it more than once. Third, verify fuel with 2 independent methods before every flight. Look in the tank, physically, with a dipstick or your calibrated eyeball, and then cross-check that against the gauges and against your own math from the last flight. If the tank and the gauge and your logbook math disagree, you stop and you figure out why on the ground, where disagreements are free. And here's a hard truth about fuel gauges. The regulations require them to be accurate at exactly 1 point empty. When the gauge reads empty, the tank is required to actually be empty. Everywhere else on the dial, the tolerance is looser than you'd like. So, the gauge is a monitor, a trend, a backup. It is not your primary fuel plan. Your primary fuel plan is how much you put in, how long you've been running, and how fast this airplane drinks. Time and burn. Watch the clock. Know the rate. Fourth, set a personal minimum and treat it like a wall, not a suggestion. Pick a number. Maybe it's 1 hour of fuel remaining. Maybe it's a specific quantity for your airplane. When you hit that number, you're landing at the nearest suitable airport. Not the preferred airport. Not the cheaper fuel. The nearest suitable one. The decision is already made, back on the ground before you ever fired up, so that you're not trying to negotiate with yourself at altitude with the needle sagging and your judgment quietly getting worse. Because that's the thing about being low on fuel. It doesn't just threaten the airplane, it degrades the pilot. You get fixated, you get optimistic in exactly the wrong direction. You start telling yourself the gauge is probably conservative, the wind will probably die down, the airport is probably just over that ridge. Probably is not a fuel quantity. Let me give you a scenario. This is the kind of thing a designated examiner might throw at you on a check ride, and honestly, it's the kind of thing that happens for real on a Tuesday afternoon. You planned a cross-country 2 hours out, land lunch 2 hours back. Your airplane holds enough for about 5 hours. On the way out, the winds were stronger than forecast, right on the nose. That 2-hour leg took you 2 hours and 20 minutes. You land, you top off. No, the fuel truck is busy, the self-serve pump is down, and you figure you've still got plenty for the way home. You launch for the return. Now, the winds that fought you on the way out, they're supposed to push you home. But the front's moving through faster than forecast, and the wind has swung around. So it's not the tailwind you were promised. Halfway home, your destination reports a ceiling dropping toward marginal. You start thinking about a divert. Your gauges are getting low, and you realize you have never actually confirmed how much was in those tanks since this morning. Where did this go wrong? It went wrong on the ground at lunch when the pump was down and you decided that was acceptable. The examiner is looking for you to see that, to recognize that the single highest leverage fuel decision you make all day is whether you top off when you have the chance on the ground with the engine off and no clock running. Fuel in the truck does you no good. Fuel in your tank is the only fuel that flies. The right answer in that scenario. The answer that keeps you out of the accident report is that you don't launch on the return leg with an unverified quantity and a marginal forecast at the far end. You wait for the pump, you get fuel somewhere else first. You change the plan while changing the plan is still cheap. Now let me connect this to the airman certification standards for a second, because this isn't just me talking. Cross-country flight planning is a required area of operation, and fuel planning sits right inside it. The ACS expects you to compute fuel required for the flight, to account for the reserve required by the regulations, and to recompute your fuel status in flight as conditions change. That last part matters. It's not a one-time calculation you do at the kitchen table and forget. The standard expects you to be recalculating, checking your actual burn against your plan, adjusting as the real world shows up. That's the skill, not the arithmetic once, but the ongoing comparison. And it lives inside your risk management too. This is exactly the kind of thing PAVE and the go, no-go decision is built to catch long before you touch the airplane. Let me leave you with the frame that changed how I think about all of this. 9151 is not a fuel plan. It is the definition of the crash you are legally required to stay away from. The regulation draws a line and says below this you are not just unsafe, you are in violation. Your job as a pilot is to never operate anywhere near that line. Your job is to make that line irrelevant by planning to land with so much margin that the legal minimum never even enters the conversation. 30 minutes in the daytime, 45 at night, memorize it because you'll need it on the knowledge test and you'll need it on the check ride. But fly to a full hour, verify with your own eyes, know your real burn, and top off every single time the airplane is stopped and the fuel is right there. Do those four things, and fuel exhaustion becomes something that happens to other people, in stories and the reports we read so we don't have to live them. My thanks to the FAA, whose plain regulatory language on 9151 and the Airman Certification Standards shaped everything we talked about today. You can find more of these breakdowns over at RadioHangar.com. Go pull that dipstick this week. Look for the number that keeps going. I'll see you back in the pattern.